Hi, it's Nicola Bird here with the Little Peace of Mind podcast, bringing you a completely fresh, new understanding to help you find freedom from panic attacks, anxiety and stress, and experience peace of mind from the inside out. So I wanted to do a slightly different kind of podcast this week, and I wanted to get my lovely, wonderful friend and mentor, Michael Neal, onto this call. And we're going to talk about creating the impossible, because that's his new book that is going to be coming out or will be out at the time of this podcast. I'm not sure.
Can we just put a sound effect in every time you say the words creating the impossible? Like, I'm
really excited about it. And one of the reasons it's so cool to have you on this podcast, Michael, is because this podcast is a product of the last Creating the Impossible program that you ran.
Because
when I started Creating the Impossible, I can't remember what my impossible project was that I chose. But on the 19th of February, I logged into a call randomly, which I wasn't planning on attending, and listened to that call. And just out of nowhere came the idea for a little peace of mind. And so on the 19th of February, this was born. Not this podcast specifically, but the idea of a little peace of mind. And very quickly, I did the first pilot and then the program, which kind of has been running now. And thousands of people later, you know, who've all engaged with the project and been able to help hundreds of people. And it's just like, that's all. I don't know. Who knows whether it would happen without Creating the Impossible, but it's pretty special that on this podcast, which wouldn't have existed but for that program.
We're now that's kind of cool. Right? I like that.
Yeah. It's really cool, and I was thinking about it today. So I read the book, and so I wanted to ask you some questions about some things in the book and some things that I know people will want to know more about. But so I wanted to start off with, it's a really different format to your previous book, The Space Within. So through working with you over the years and just being, you know, a client and seeing you work and operate, like, you haven't been around the kind of how-tos and the tasks. There's checkbooks in it and there's homework in it, and you tell people to do stuff, Michael.
I know it's making some people so happy and other people so uncomfortable.
I know. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because compared to The Space Within, which was like the other end of the extreme from that, right, the other end of the continuum from that, like, what is this? Tell me about the thinking behind the move back towards the kind of the real practical element of understanding can do for us.
There are two things behind it that I'm conscious of. I mean, there may be some deep undercurrent that I don't understand. But one is, I've always seen this understanding as the inside of a, like the beautiful space inside a castle. And there are three doors into the castle. And one door is the sort of psychological door. And so the Inside Out Revolution was my attempt to kind of enter this castle through the psychological door and to look at that we're living in the feeling of our thinking, not the feeling of the world, and the implications of that and how that plays out through life. One of the doors is spiritual. And so in The Space Within, I wanted to lead people into the castle through the spiritual door, through the sort of a deeper sense of our true nature, what's before our psychology, what's underneath our psychology, what's true for all people, not just idiosyncratic to us. But there's a third door to the castle, which is the practical. And so Creating the Impossible is my attempt to lead people into the castle through the practical door. And I fully expect different people to be drawn to different doors, but ultimately it's all about the same castle. So that's one part of it. Now the other part of it is, I found that a lot of people, because they came to the castle through the spiritual door, the psychological door, through other teachers or me, they don't think there is a practical. And in my mind, there so clearly is that I also wanted to show people that the goal of coming into the castle isn't to get trapped inside its walls. It's to have a place of refuge, of home, of safety, from which you can venture out into the world and do cool shit.
Yeah.
And so this is the book about doing the cool shit.
Yeah, I mean, that's so been my experience with A Little Peace of Mind.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, yeah. I could, you know, having discovered the principles, I suppose, although it's not really my style, to sit around inside the castle enjoying the Zen experience of having my well-being in the moment, no matter what my circumstances. But mind's a creative force, right? It wants it as if it's a person, but like wants to, like I always think mind needs fingers to type the actual books and to create the vases. And
yeah, were you there when Aaron was teaching on Supercoach Academy? And somebody challenged him about, well, if it's all mind, if it's all coming from this deeper intelligence, yeah. You know, if it's coming from God, where do you get off charging? And to which Aaron responded, well, until God gets his own PayPal account, I'm good for it to come through me.
I love that. I don't remember that, but that does sound like very much like Aaron, yeah. No, I like that. But so for those people who haven't bumped into the program before, and so this is a totally new, this is a totally new book. This is maybe the first thing they've read of you, or like this is the first time they've heard of you. And I know it might be for a lot of my listeners, or they've definitely heard me talking about you in the past, so they might already be checking you out. But the initial part, I mean, the book's divided into two, right? So you have the kind of the foundational piece, and then you take people actually through the kind of 90-day program, right, of creating the impossible itself, which was just like a massive gift when you get to that bit as well. You're like, oh, he's not just talking, he's going to teach us how to do stuff. But one of the things that you get people to do is pick an impossible project. Now, I've seen through the work I've done with clients and seen through the work you've done with me and so many other people in this conversation that this conversation makes what you think impossible possible. So I see clients now going out to the shops. I see me driving on a motorway. I see me driving to my mom's house, right? Or doing things that, running this program, right? Things that looked impossible to me before, you know, a few years ago, that now I do without giving a second thought to. It's made the impossible possible. But in this book, so you get people to pick a project, or in your program to pick a project that looks impossible. So like, what's the reasoning behind that? Why wouldn't we choose something to work on that, well, at least we've got a hope of succeeding in?
That's what my wife asked.
Yeah, if I'm going to spend 90 days doing something, Michael, then, and my time is very precious, I'm a busy lady, right? And I'm quite happy to go out and create, and I'm quite happy to spend 90 days on it. But what's the point if it's not going to be successful at the end of it?
Well, there are multiple points, but I'll try and pick the key ones. Mm. So the first point is, most people I'm only going to do it if I think it's possible, wind up chasing 1/16th of their dream. So it's not what they really want, it's what they think they can get. And that has always struck me as a shame. There's a story I have in my first book, You Can Have What You Want, about a man who, good man, goes to heaven at the end of his life and is being shown around heaven. And there's a lot of doors in heaven. I don't know if you know this. But, you know, so he's, you know, the angels show him a door and show him all the beautiful stuff behind that. But there's one door that he begins to notice every time they walk past it, it's head down and no one wants to let him in there. And he finally gets really curious and goes, well, what's behind that door? Oh, you don't want to go in there. No, I really do. What's behind the door? He said, well, I can't stop you, but I'm just telling you, you don't want to go in there. Well, now the guy has to go in there, right? So he opens the door and it is filled with everything he ever could imagine having wanted. Like, it's got the coolest toys that he wanted as a kid, and it's got the coolest tech that he wanted as a grown-up, and it's got the puppy that he never got. And it's like, it's got everything. He's like, oh my God, this is great. Why didn't you want me to go in here? And the angel said, this is everything that was waiting for you on earth, but you didn't go for it. Now, that's part of it. What we think is impossible also usually is what we really want. Mm. So that's one part. Now, a second point is that Most people who are any good at creating anything are really hard workers. They're willing to pay the price. They're willing to put in the hours. They're doers. Now, that's a great trait. Me too. But because it looks to them like the secret of their success is hard work, the only way to get more successful is to work harder. Creating the impossible is built on an understanding of how the mind works, how the universe works, that shows that anything of any real scope in the world can't be done through hard work alone. You may need to work hard along the way, but there's a whole other element of luck and coincidence and chance and synchronicity that is automatic. There's no way you've created anything of note without it. But we either dismiss that bit or we worship it. We either go, no, it's all just hard work. That happened, but so what? Or we go, ooh, it's magic. I'm just going to try and do the magic without the hard work. And actually, that's not how things get created in the world.
Yeah.
And so by having people choose something that they know they won't be able to pull off through hard work alone, it kind of forces them to explore the deeper capacity of the mind.
Yeah, because anything you kind of would pick that would be possible, you kind of got half an idea about how it would probably happen anyway, right? You kind of got the steps in mind. And I keep using this, the Little Piece of Mind project as an example to bounce that against. But it's like when I started out, when the idea came to me, I didn't even have a goal in mind. It just looked like I was going to do something obvious as a result of that conversation. And like I had no idea how, because I didn't really know where I was going, to be honest. But I didn't have a plan how. And that's really different experience for me.
Yeah, and that is for most achievers. Mm. It's somebody asked me who the book was for, and I'm sure I'll come up with different answers over time as I get asked the question more. But the answer that came out that first time I was asked was, it's for two groups of people. It's for people who struggle to create in the world, because it kind of presents how it works in a way that most people can quickly pick up and start to use. Yeah. But it's also for people who've learned to create in the world the hard way, who've been successful but are in constant danger of burnout and exhaustion and stress, pressure, showing them a way that they don't have to give up on creating amazing things in the world. They can just give up the stress and pressure part.
Yeah. And one of the questions that you ask right at the end of the book, there's like four questions that you ask. And one of them is like, I think I might be misquoting, but it was something around like how much of the creating, like how much of it was you? Yeah. There's a question that's about that. And I was reflecting on that and I was thinking, that first day when I turned up to your house to do my intensive with you, and I was like, oh, it's 100% me. I am taking, like, I had no idea there was anything else, right? So of course it's still me. Like, I did everything. I came up with the idea. I came up with a goal. I did what it took, did things other people wouldn't do to do it, because
it's a big girl pencil.
Yeah, exactly. And I will achieve what I want, and I've achieved everything that I've wanted through my own sheer determination and hard work and all the rest of it. And as I look at this project, it's like so not me. It's like I feel like I said earlier, mind needs fingers to type the blog post. So I put my body in front of the computer and my laptop and my fingers type. And then it needs somebody to switch the Zoom on at the beginning. It needs a body to switch the Zoom on at the beginning of our group calls. And then I just go, basically, Nick goes, has a cup of tea in the other room, pretty much. And mine shows up and uses her mouth to speak for an hour. And then who shows up and what opportunities show up and all the rest of it. It's just been, mind has required me to say yes and type the buttons and sign the forms and agree the whatevers. But it's like, I have no idea where it's going next, and no idea of the direction. And that is such a different experience to create and be in life from, like, I cannot tell you what a difference creating in this way is from doing it the old fashioned way, where it was totally up to me and I was clinging on by my fingertips and I had to hold on and hold it all together, because if it's to be, it really was up to me. And if I let go for a minute, the whole thing was going to go to shit. Then just doesn't feel that way anymore. Really doesn't feel that. So I'm free now. I'm free like to experiment, to be pretty casual with what shows up and all the rest of it. It's like a really different way.
Yeah. Well, that's another, you know, I hadn't thought of this when you first asked, but that's another reason for having people choose an impossible project, is because once you start to get the hang of this, when new ideas occur to you that seem ridiculous and impossible, that doesn't seem relevant.
Yeah.
Right? You don't dismiss them in the way that you would have in the past, because you're like, yeah, that could, yeah, I have no idea how that could work. Let's do it.
Yeah, I've had exactly that experience this week with someone coming up to me and go, oh, we could do this and that and the other. And I'm like, that is so beyond my capability, but okay.
I'm in. Yeah, exactly.
Kind of like, I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, well, why not? Because we're just going to make it up as we go along, and that's the best way. So in the book as well, there's one bit I was really fascinated by, because I know it's going to be really relevant for the people listening to this call. And you talk about this with regard to a project, but I think it's true of anything in life, and that's why I'm really interested in it, is talking about, you know, given that our state of mind is a variable element, right? So many people, myself included, will check in with, well, how am I feeling today before I move ahead with something? Right. And especially the clients that I have listening to this with anxiety, they're like, check in, how do I feel today? Can I go out to the shops today? I don't know. Let me just check how I feel. Right? Or can I go back to work? Oh, I don't know. How am I feeling right now today? Oh, no. If I went into work feeling like this today, like I do today, it would be a disaster. So I won't go. And or on a practical level, when people are, you know, I know clients who are trying to write books, or clients who are launching new businesses, or they're growing their business. And there's something about when people start to grasp this understanding, where they kind of almost give a heavier weight to how they're feeling. Like they kind of think that, well, if it doesn't feel simple and easy and totally like I'm in the flow and really happy, then that's not the right thing to do. I'm only going to go where it's pink fluffy clouds direction kind of thing. And if I'm not feeling like totally positive about it, that's a sign from wisdom I shouldn't be doing it. Right? And you talk about playing regardless of how we feel.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that could be a game changer.
Yeah.
It
certainly was a game changer for me. People either completely ignore their state of mind or they worship it. They make it the all and everything. Which to me, if you were going on a journey and you had a compass, to ignore the compass would be ridiculous. But to only go in exactly true north, if you were trying to go north, would mean you'd run into a lot of trees and buildings and cliffs. Right? The compass is a useful tool. It's useful, a useful guiding principle. So you don't want to ignore it, but you don't want to follow it slavishly either. And that's sort of more the role that our thoughts and feelings have. That if in a way, the enemy of success is not feeling bad. The enemy of success is self-consciousness. It's self-obsession. It's making everything about you, looking at everything through the eyes of, well, what does this mean about me? And how does this make me feel? And that kind of self-directed, where we're always looking back at ourselves, takes our eye off what we want to create.
Yeah.
It takes our eyes off the world. So it's not so much, I found that the most difficult part of the book to write. I probably did more rewrites in that part of the book than any other, because it's difficult to express that it's not up to you, but it's not up to you. It's not about how you feel, but it's not about how you feel. Right? I know, and I believe me. That's why I'm glad I finally wrote it down in a way that you could understand it, because when I try to talk about it, I'm all over the shop. Because there is an element of truth to both things. It is not true that you have to be in a great feeling to create great things.
Yeah.
It is true that if you're up in your head, not really paying attention to what you're doing, you'll struggle.
Yeah.
So it's relevant, but it's not the all and everything. And most of the things we do to try and get ourselves into the right state of mind to create actually take us deeper into self-consciousness, which is the enemy of creation.
Right. Yeah, no, I see what you mean, I think.
Well, you and me both. Look, it's one of these things that I can see it really clearly when it's happening.
Yeah.
So I can just notice, oh man, I am so in my head about this. I need to take a break. Nothing good is going to come.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that I have to feel great before I write the next book or I write the next chapter or I record the next podcast or I take the next meeting. It just means I need to be willing to get out of my head long enough to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think then, you know, what rings a bell for me over the last week is being invited to do this new project and I'm feeling apprehensive about it, a bit anxious about it, a bit nervous, like, oh, I don't know what's making me feel, but maybe I should say no. And then just knowing that that's got nothing to do with whether I actually want to do the project or not. Saying yes anyway, knowing that if that state of mind were to continue, I probably wouldn't be the most helpful participant on the project. But who knows, because the future is an unknown equation, right?
It would be like in your car, confusing the radio for the GPS.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So our feelings are the radio. We can drive where we're going regardless of what's playing on the radio. It can be news, it can be classical music, it can be pop music, it can be whatever, it can be, you know, angry talk, right? That is irrelevant to where we're going.
Yeah.
But if we're paying so much attention to the radio that we don't hear the nav system, that could be a problem.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So if I, like, as an example, like if I'm feeling, or if I think about a client of mine, like if she's feeling sad, but she's deciding whether to do something, she doesn't really take that into account because it's not a big deal. Right? But I have another client who has depression. So if she hears sad on the radio, that's like, oh, well, hang on a minute. I better listen to what the radio is saying first before I decide whether to go left or right. Right. Because it's a big deal. It's like front page news. And so that's true. And I know that if that feeling of like nervousness or apprehension continued while I was doing this project, I probably wouldn't be performing at my best, but I can dismiss that because I don't know what the future is going to bring in terms of how I'm going to feel in the moment. So it's like unnecessary noise, isn't it? So you can decide to move ahead, whatever. You can do the thing you want to do regardless of how you feel.
Right. Room. And you don't have to have the radio tuned into the right station in order to drive.
Yeah.
So you certainly will enjoy the drive a little bit more when it's tuned into music that you like.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true. Yeah. But that's not a determining factor in where you go.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think that's so cool. So I remember you talking about that on Creating the Impossible and just saying like, yeah, given that our state of mind and our feelings change all the time, it seems like a pretty rubbish tool to try and navigate by.
And that's exactly why, because it's so changeable and it's so arbitrary.
Yeah.
Right. You see something, it reminds you of something else. You start going back to the feelings of that thing that the thing reminded you. And like, you're so far away from reality.
Yeah.
But it feels real.
Yeah. So this brings me to my next question, which is, because I read the book all in one sitting. So maybe I noticed this, and I don't know if you noticed it as you were writing it. There's a lot, you mention about overthinking a lot in the book. Right? I don't know if that's just your thing you're noticing a lot at the moment, but it came through quite a lot in the book.
Yeah.
But I'd love you to talk a little bit more about it, because it strikes me just through the work I've done with business coaching clients and things that, like, it's constant overthinking. I mean, we all do it, right? But as soon as you start overthinking, it's like, I'd say to a client, can you write 4 blog posts? And it's like, oh yeah, but how do I do them? And what pictures shall I use? And what shall I put them out? And what if people don't like them? And what shall I do with them? And it's like, the answer is yes or no.
Well, so absolutely. Overthinking is the way in the book. I probably use overthinking a little bit more than self-consciousness, but it's kind of that same thing where I'm so in my head that I'm not available. I'm not available to this inner creativity. I'm not available to this innate intelligence. I'm not available to the world and the opportunities that are surrounding me because I'm overthinking everything.
Yeah.
Now, the cure for overthinking is not trying to think less.
Yeah.
Because that's just gonna, right, because it's like, oh God, how do I do that? Oh my God, let me think about it, right? And then it just gets horrible, right? So when we see how random and fickle thought is, and when we see how the view from the sidelines is never the view from the game, right? That what it looks like when you're looking at it from the side is never what it looks like when you're actually in the game playing.
Yeah.
It stops seeming relevant to think so much. And so you just do it less. So it's much more about seeing how it works than it is about trying to do it differently. Because when you see how it works, you will do it differently. You just literally will. It will make no sense to you to overthink something because you know you have no idea till you're in there doing it.
Yeah.
And then it's done. You don't have to practice anything. See, this is what I love about this. Well, it is obviously much more practical, much more idea-minded, much more, hey, try this, than the other two books that I've written about the Inside Out Understanding. It still is absolutely built on the same premise, which is understanding, getting a deeper understanding will change all the behaviors that you are trying to change through force of will or discipline or practice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Because the amount of years I spent trying to like work less or slow down or do this or do that, and then now I just work differently. Like, why would I not?
I think I use the analogy even in the book that to say to somebody who in their mind is falling towards the ground without a parachute, don't be scared. F off. You know, whereas if you can show them that they're not actually falling towards the ground, they're falling towards a big puffy mattress that's going to catch them and feel really cool, and they're going to want to go up and say, can I do it again?
Yeah.
Well, then you won't be scared. But it's because you see clearly what's really happening, not because somebody told you not to be scared.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, we can say, oh, don't overthink. You're just overthinking it. Right. But I know you posted a bit about that on your blog post recently about when Maisie was asking you, Dad, are you overthinking it again? And that was so helpful to me because I hadn't realized the fact that I had been overthinking. It was totally...
That's actually excerpted from the book. That whole story is in the book.
Yes. It's such a great story. And I know when I first read it that I realized that something that I'd been totally wrapped up in for the whole of the week about like which direction to go in with a particular piece of work, that... when I read that, it was the realization of the fact, oh, that's what's going on. I'm just overthinking it. And then it stopped. It just vanished. It went, like it disappeared in that moment, just through the realization of it.
Right. And that's the beauty of it, is that's already built into it.
Yeah.
We don't have to learn how to do that.
No.
We just have to allow it.
Yeah. It's like, and also if you see it, when you see it, once and you get how unhelpful it is. Because before I used to think that thinking a lot about stuff was how else were you gonna figure it out unless you thought a lot about stuff. Right. Yeah. And that's one of the main barriers I see to people actually getting this understanding at all, is like we're trying so hard to figure it out and work it out and all the rest of it. And overthinking the principles to try and understand them. But actually no, that's the process of realization is so different, right? Where you suddenly realize, oh, every time I'm overthinking stuff, I'm just getting in my own way. That's right. A hindrance. That's not a help.
Right. Hello? And as soon as somebody sees that, they just do it less.
Yeah.
Right? And I think the missing piece is that people don't realize that what we do makes perfect sense given the thinking we have that looks real to us.
Yeah.
Right. Given the way we think the world works, what we do actually makes total sense.
Yeah.
It's just that we're wrong most of the time about how the world works.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really cool. So one of the other things you talked about, and I'd like you to talk about this a bit as well, is that you talked about, it's a little quote from the book. So the future cannot be predicted, but futures can be invented. And you talk about the fact of us being a virtual reality generator. Hmm. So tell us a little bit more about...
Well, if you think about it, it's kind of obvious that the future is made up, right? In other words, when it happens, then it's not made up in the same way. But right now, You're making up a future and living into it. So am I. So is everybody. Right? And if that future is positive, you probably feel pretty good about it. And if it's negative, you probably feel pretty terrible about it. But either way, you're making it up. So it's like there's an old Henry Ford quote, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. Well, I've always thought of a sort of a slightly more accurate statement is, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you don't actually know. So why limit yourself by guessing?
Yeah.
Right? See, the idea that we could usefully predict the future, that it would be helpful to predict the future, it doesn't stand up to much scrutiny. What is true is that at some point, things will be different than they are today, right? That's true. But it's my unwarranted belief in my accuracy as a fortune teller that causes me to think that if I think it's impossible, I shouldn't bother creating it.
Yeah.
And that's really the fundamental thing I see hold people back, is they believe their own thinking when it tells them they can't do something or it can't be done. And if you start to see, look, I've got a kind of an advantage in this because I've spent the last 12 years with Hay House Publishers, who are the publishers of many of the top psychics in the world. And I've met some of these people and they can do things that I don't understand and are really cool. But I notice with interest that none of them play the lottery, none of them play the horses, none of them gamble, none of them do the things that if you really could predict the future, you would do. Now, that's not to say they can't sense patterns. That's not to say they can't do some cool stuff. But if the top psychics in the world can't predict the future, why do we think we can? Why do we put so much stock in our made-up idea of what's going to happen if? And if you start to see how pointless that is, again, you just not so inclined to do it. And the funny thing is, if you're not making up the future, you're free to just create in the moment, without worrying too much about what's going to happen. And when you do that, really cool stuff tends to happen.
Yeah, I'm thinking about my clients who are exceptionally gifted at creating scary looking scenarios of the future, right? And actually, I did a podcast episode with Brooke a couple of weeks ago, or a few weeks ago. And she said one of her first big insights was, she came away from some training she'd been to and she had had the realization that 90% of what I think about, 90% of everything I worry about never, ever happens. And with that, she stopped worrying about it, all kind of fell away. And you know, yeah, my clients are absolute masters of creating scary looking scenarios, which prevent them being able to do just the ordinary things in life. You know, for them, creating the impossible is, you know, because you can read Creating the Impossible about, oh, well, I want to write a book, or I want to lose some weight, or I want to make a film, or I want to travel to space, or whatever, right? Like, yeah. There's some really crazy goals that come out of that. But for some people, it's just like, I just want to be able to pick my kids up from school. That looks impossible to me. Yeah. And what I love about the book is the versatility of it, because you can, you can take this book and apply it, not a word that often gets used in this conversation, but you can apply it to anything that looks impossible to you right now.
Well, and that's it. The title isn't Creating the Grandiose.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's not about that. It really is just about, if we take away the idea that we can usefully predict the future, then the question becomes, what do you want to create? What would you like to see in the world that isn't there right now? What possibilities would you like to play a role into bringing into being?
Now, this is a question that I used to have a lot when I was trying to pick my Creating the Impossible project, which was never an easy thing for me to do. Yeah. And I've done Creating the Impossible, what, three times or four times or something? But there was a caveat on it, which was, you can pick whatever you like, but you don't want to have too much on it. Now, for my clients who are thinking, God, you know what, it'd be impossible. I would love to go to my daughter's wedding, or I'd love to be able to pick my kids up from school, or go to the school play next week. Right?
Yeah.
They have so much on that. And that's why I pretty much couldn't have any of the goals that I wanted to choose for Creating the Impossible, because it was like, well, I want to be able to do this. Well, A, that's impossible. And B, it would mean so much to me if I could do that thing.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that. Like, you're not allowed to pick something you've got a lot on.
Well, of course you're allowed to.
Is that right?
But it's me attempting to help people through one of the biggest pitfalls in creating. So I think of the program as training wheels, right? The program part of the book is, hey, let me hold your hand the first time you go through this so you start to see this for yourself. Once you see it for yourself, you can pick anything you want. But because the biggest thing that I see get in people's ways, especially when they're first trying to do this, is that they, because what they want matters so much to them, they don't see clearly. They don't see it as separate to them. Mm. They're overthinking before they even begin. Mm. They're self-conscious and self-obsessed before they even start, because the thing is really about them, not about what they want to see in the world.
Right.
And it just makes it much harder to touch that space of creativity and wisdom and insight from which all the good stuff comes. Mm. Because you've got so much noise before you even start. Even that you can get past. But usually for people's first time, I really encourage them to not make it, you know, it would be like somebody who wants to learn the piano. And you go, great. And then saying, yeah, I want to start with this Chopin piece, the concerto for left hand. And you're like, really? Okay. I think you're probably going to find that difficult.
Yeah.
Maybe let's start with chopsticks and work our way up. I mean, I'm not saying you can't learn Chopin. I'm just saying I wouldn't start there.
Yeah. It's like picking the goal. Like I want to make my coaching business, you know, I want to make six figures in my coaching business by the end of the 90 days. And when you explore why, it's like, so that I can feel that I've really done it. I've really made it. Or I want to lose 20 pounds. And why? Just because it's something I've always really wanted to do. And I know it's the one thing that if I could just shift this, it would be everything. And I know that for me in the end, when I chose the more playful projects just to practice on, what I would get from the book and from the program is the journey of exploring the journey of creativity rather than the aim being about, well, I got to have this thing at the end. Because I don't know what percentage of people actually have the thing they start off with intending at the end. Certainly I've done it four times and I never have. And I've never regretted it because I've learned something.
No, and I'm often surprised by how many people do.
Yeah.
Like, because it's not really designed to achieve it in 90 days. Now, a lot of people do, if it's a project they really want, wind up in the course of a year creating it.
Yeah.
But that really isn't the point. And the problem with so I call them loaded goals.
Yeah.
You know what you're saying, where it's like, yeah, and then if this, then this, then this, and it's like you're stacking weights on it. And by the time you go to create it, it's already got so much on it that it's hard before you even start. And so I'm all for the whimsical. I'm all for the, let's do Tai Chi on the Eiffel Tower with LeBron James. Let's get married in 8 weeks.
Let's learn this dance move.
Right. you know, because you'll learn the same thing about creating and about yourself, but without all that weight, all that weightiness. Then when you've seen how it works and you go back and take a fresh look at building your coaching practice or launching your business or all of that, it doesn't look so hard because you already kind of have a clearer sense of how it works. And again, it's a suggestion, right? I mean, I don't kick people off the program, but if I say to them, and I often do early on, so, you know, for the sake of what? That's like day three or day four. You know, is this ends or means? Is this something you just want to see in the world? Or is this something that you think is going to open up this and mean that? And it just, it really is like, how hard do you want to make this?
Yeah. Cause I guess most people would come to it well, of course I'm going to pick the project of the thing that I've said I've wanted to do for the last 3 years, but I never have. Like, don't pick that one.
Probably not. Yeah. Probably not. And look, in the book, I do my best to kind of go through as many different, there's a whole week of choosing your project.
Yeah. There's one bit where you talk about creating the result versus trying to create a feeling.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a huge part of it is that, like you were saying, a lot of the things that we say we want because we think it'll make us feel a certain way. So I've got an exercise. I'm pretty sure you and I will have done it, but we can do it with your listeners.
Yeah.
Right. I call it the millionaire exercise. But for some of you, if you're already millionaires, we'll call it the billionaire exercise. But I'm going to use the millions, right? So I ask people on a group, I'll say, so who wants to know what it feels like to have $1 million, to be a millionaire? They're like, oh, yeah. Most hands in the room will go up. And I'll go, okay, so close your eyes and tune into your body and get a sense of how you feel right now, just as a baseline. And people do it, and they get a sense of how they feel right now. And then I say, this is what it feels like to be a millionaire. Because there's no feeling inherent in your bank balance. But we think there will be. There's no feeling inherent in starting your business. There's no feeling inherent in reaching a certain target. But we think there will be. And if we're chasing the feeling by trying to create in the world, we're doing things 180 degrees backwards. Because our feelings don't come from the world. They're generated by a thought inside us. And they change all the time. And I've met enough miserable millionaires and enough happy millionaires to know that it's nothing to do with their bank balance and everything to do with their thinking.
So why create a tool?
Because it's super fun. It's one of the most enjoyable things you can do with an incarnation, right? As long as you've got a body and a mind and you're here on earth, it genuinely, I think, is a big part of why we're here. And if you want to get kind of religious with it, you can say, you know, that to me is what it means to be created in God's image, the ultimate creator. If you want to get not religious, but practical with it, you can see that that's the basis of the mind. Is it's the most creative instrument on the planet. And it's always creating. And if we can learn to harness it and tap into it and allow ourselves to be used by it, oh my God, suddenly life becomes so exciting. It becomes thrilling to be alive, instead of, and I quote George Bernard Shaw incessantly through the book, but you know, this is the true joy in life, to be used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, instead of a selfish clod of ailments and grievances complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy.
Wow.
That's why we create.
Rewind that bit, listeners, and just listen to that quote again. That was really cool. That's really cool. And it's just like, I've got a cake course I've got my eye on. and I sent it to my friend and I was like, just for the joy of it, just to go and create like beautiful flowers and this stuff in form that is nothing to start with. And then to be able to create it just for the joy of it.
Yeah.
Like that is so different from, yeah, but I've got to get 20 clients because I've got to create X amount of money because I've got to, create a payment to the mortgage company at the end of the month. And if I don't do it this way, then that. So that, I'm going to choose that one because that's the sensible thing. And that's where I should be spending my time, not just in creating for the joy of it.
Well, and the funny thing,
naughty, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But what people don't realize is that actually, when you allow yourself to just create for the fun of it, all the other stuff winds up getting taken care of along the way.
Yeah.
And again, it's why I think it was worth writing out a day by day program that you can follow, because otherwise you lose faith a little bit. What the program does is it just kind of keeps you engaged long enough to go through all of those cycles of boom and bust and doubt and hope and possibility and impossibility, and see that if you just stay in the game, if you keep your feet moving, really cool things happen.
Yeah, so there was a quote as well related to that I just wanted to read out to you. Well, you wrote it, so you'll know this quote. But this kind of thing about like, how am I doing as people move through the program, right? And I have, you know, my clients ask themselves that all the time, like, how am I doing? How am I doing? How am I doing? Like, am I getting it yet? Am I getting it yet? And it was like, and this applied to your project, but also to anyone who is in this conversation and going, yeah, but am I getting it yet? Is it working? And is it doing what I want it to do? And you wrote, if I can read my own writing, that like your current feelings of optimism and pessimism are a reflection The current feelings of optimism and pessimism, we think they're a reflection. This isn't actually a quote. This is something like this. But not this. is a reflection. We think that's a reflection of how things are going, right? So if I feel optimistic right now, I think that things are going really well. And if I feel pessimistic right now, I think things are going terribly and, you know, I'm not getting it, or I'm not achieving my goal. And we think they're a predictor of performance, but all they're telling us about is our current thinking in the moment, right? Yeah. Of the project, of how you're working on it in the moment. And actually how you're doing is completely divorced from how you're feeling about it. So I'll have people who are like, I feel really hopeless. I feel like I'm never going to get this. I've been looking in this direction. You've been telling me to look in this direction. It's not working. I can see there's no hope for me. Right. And it's like, that's not true. That's totally your state of mind in this moment right now. Right.
So let me give a really practical example of that from my own business. So a few months back, you know, we always have a number of courses going on that are at various stages of full to empty or empty to full. And we had one course where one day, in the course of a day, two people dropped out. And I got, you know, an email from somebody on my team going, oh my God, okay, we're never going to fill all these courses. We're not going to reach any of our targets. We need a plan B. We need to drop this and generate. And it was this really well thought through panicked email. And I fortunately didn't get my thinking stirred up when I read it, and I saw it for what it was. And I wrote back and said, hey, all that's changed from yesterday is there's this much guaranteed cash. And it wasn't a huge number that's not in our bank balance. Mm. Otherwise, we're every bit as close and far away to our targets as we were yesterday. Mm. So there's no point in changing anything based on this, given that amount of money is well within our leeway. And it was funny because when they saw that, they calmed right down. Within the week, those places, somebody else had taken them and everything went on as it is. Now that happens every day where people leap to a conclusion, either a really positive one. It's like, oh, somebody booked. I'm going to be a millionaire. Right. Let's go out and buy new stuff.
Yeah.
You know, or, oh my God, no bookings today. I need to quit and take on another business, perhaps plumbing or something else that, you know, is very solid and reliable.
Yeah, both those are familiar to me.
Yeah. And it's just based on a misunderstanding of where our feelings come from, of where those feelings of hope and hopelessness, optimism and pessimism come from. And they don't come from reality.
So how do you know, like if you're doing a Creating the Impossible project and let's say you're writing a book, for example, creating a business, like how do you, if you can't rely on your judgment in that moment to decide whether this project has got legs or not, how do you know whether to move forward, or how do you know when it's time to quit?
So
like
there isn't a one size fits all answer, but there are a few guidelines that are pretty helpful. First off, some things do lend themselves to measuring numbers.
Yeah.
Right. You can actually, with some projects, you can look at the numbers and you can go, okay, well, these are the numbers, and at these numbers, it's worth it, and at these numbers, it's not. So years ago, I had the possibility of taking over some syndicated radio for my radio program. And I was very excited about the possibility because it could have been huge. But in the end, three stations came on board with me of the 250 or something that we looked at. And it would have taken 50 stations to make it profitable. Mm. And I might have gotten there, but I looked at it and I just went, looking at the numbers, this makes no sense to devote 4 or 5 hours a day, 6 days a week to something that might pay off somewhere down line, unless I'm dying to do it. And I realized I wasn't.
Yeah.
So the numbers were helpful there to me. Now, here's the difference. Had I thought, yeah, but I just so love doing this that I want to do it anyways, and if it pays off later, great. Well, then I would have stuck with it. Mm. Not because I thought it would work, but because I was loving the idea of creating it.
Yeah.
So, as I say, the numbers are sometimes relevant, but far more relevant are your level of enthusiasm for it, are your level of love for it, or your level of, oh my God, this would just be so cool. I'm just going to go for it anyways.
But surely that's just a state of mind that you're in this present moment.
And this is why I say you've kind of got to get a feel for it in yourself between the moment by moment, I'm hopeful, I'm hopeless, I'm hopeful, I'm hopeless, and that underlying sense of direction. We've all got an inner sense of direction. We've all got a GPS. And if we learn to listen to that instead of the radio that's changing songs all the time, we will know. Mm. It's possibly the least helpful thing I've said during this entire conversation. And it's no less true for that.
Yeah.
There is something in you that knows beyond your mood.
Yeah. Well, that's it. It's like, it's for me, it's always like, it's really simple and it's really quiet. And it's just like, yeah, but I want to.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that. Yeah,
it's but so I want to. But I want to. And you can hardly hear it amongst the cacophony of the mood swings. Yeah. And oh, yeah, but it's going to be like this. Oh, no, it's like this. What were they going to say about this? Oh, yeah, it's going really well. And underneath, it's just like,
no, absolutely. That's really well put, because it is like that. And it's why, if you start to see, you don't have to listen to the music, you don't have to listen to the noise, it's easier to hear that. Yeah, I want to.
Yeah, well, that's what I want to listen to, right? That when personally, yeah. Me now, I'm not even deciding which way my business is going, but when I'm, I don't know, moving forward, however I'm doing that, it's like, I'm not interested in the radio show. Like, I'm not interested unless I'm caught up in it in that particular moment, but I know what I'm listening for, and it's that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that one shift, right, is one of the biggest shifts that I hope people get from reading this book, is to learn to listen to that, and that we don't have to listen to the other.
Yeah.
Because that will serve you for the rest of your life.
Yeah. And for me, before I started working with you, before I discovered this understanding, I didn't even know the radio was so loud. I had no idea. No one had ever told me. No one had ever pointed me to. I had no understanding that was even there.
Yeah.
That was even available. And so, and then when you get eyes for it, you can tune into it. And that's what makes the impossible become more possible. Cool. What a good place to end.
Indeed.
So if people want to get the book, or if they want to find out more about what you're up to and join your next Creating the Impossible program, which I highly recommend from personal experience, where's the best place for them to go?
Well, best place to go is michaelneal.org, and you can find links to the program there. There is, I think you can also go direct creatingtheimpossible.net, but michaelneal.org is the safe one, because any programs will always be there, and you can get the book there at all good booksellers near you.
Yeah, wonderful. So definitely, definitely highly recommend it. Thank you, Michael, for your time today.
Thanks, Nick. That was fun.
It's been really good fun to have a conversation like that.
If you're curious to find out more about what I've been talking about on this episode, the best place to start is to go to alittlepeaceofmind.co.uk, and there you'll find my audio, Freedom from Anxiety, and you can listen to that. Is the best place to start to get some of this understanding into your own bones, so it can start making a difference to your life. Until next time, I'll speak to you later.